I mean, this was an individual that nobody heard of. And unfortunately, Rab was paroled like 12 years later. We had developed programs at that particular point right after Attica. There was a lot of reforms, and we were able to develop programs. And Rab was released on parole, and he was murdered almost 60 days after he was released. He was killed mysteriously. And there's a lot of brothers who were activists in jail who went out and were killed mysteriously. Malcolm X's former bodyguard, when he was released from prison, he was a major Muslim force inside of prison for 25 years. When he was released from prison, he was murdered.
Daruba, let me just interject to say that, excuse me, as you describe, as Carl and Bob described for us, what is going on in this regard, it seems to me, and I hope we can institutionalize this here, an even more regular address to these issues on our air, because I'm very concerned now that with this new administration, the reaction to the presence of a political activity within the prison system is going to increase tenfold, and that the pressures brought on people who have or seek to have a political consciousness, is this going to be devastating?
Well, we could tell by the demonstrations at the inauguration and the demonstrations at the previous conventions and at the International Conference of Corporations that they call the World Bank and all these different meetings, that the United States and its paramilitary police are not going to tolerate dissent in this country. They're not going to tolerate dissent along any, I mean, the country is in total denial of, as been pointed out by many of the presenters on BAI, is in total denial of Bush's theft of the last election. I think that when we look at something like the issue of political prisoners, we have to really understand that we can get these brothers and sisters out of prison. And the way we get these brothers and sisters out of prison is by capitalizing on the historical moment and building mass movements of our people who were disenfranchised, and making the issue of political prisoners a primary point for our elected officials to have to deal with if they want to be elected. And I'm talking about grassroots elected officials. I'm not talking about big willies, you know, in Hillary Clinton's, because we know the Hillary Clintons and these individuals are not going to deal with Black Liberation Army political prisoners. As you pointed out, the Puerto Rican political prisoners that were released were the ones that basically had not had any particular direct a connection to bombings, violent connections to bombings, or they had renounced their politics in whole or in part. And these were the individuals that were released. So we cannot expect the government or the state, and these prisoners, we're talking about state prisoners, by the way, we cannot forget, permit the state to keep them in prison. Now, Pataki is backing up, and the Republican Party in this city, in this state, is backing up off of the most heinous features of the Rockefeller drug program. And they're doing that because they realize that we have an issue, we have an idea, and we have a means to organize people around the prison industrial complex, that we can make this a serious issue, or we can make it a serious issue for economic enslavement. What we're talking about here is the urban areas that are concentrations of Blacks and Latinos are serving as plantations for these crackers upstate. That's what really happening, and this is a massive dislocation of resources for our community. Not to mention the fact that most ex-offenders are not even given the opportunity to sign themselves back up and to register to vote. All of these things, we're talking about over 100,000 people in the state of New York alone who are ex-offenders and their families who are not registered to vote. And so when we understand what's involved here, we understand that our political prisoners are not that far away from being sprung from prison.
Daruba, let me say that what you just wrote, I think, is very important, because the fact is, in New York State, your right to vote can be restored, but there's a process involved. And I think one of the things we have to do, again, in building this movement, is to say to people, you know, you've got to be involved in this way, too. Your politicization is also going to involve...
But, you know, you just pointed out, Clayton, that a lot, they were afraid of a lot of prisoners coming out of prison.
Exactly.
I'm saying to you is, you have a natural anti-law enforcement constituency in these people. These are people that we could vote DAs into office in Brooklyn and Manhattan, because we're talking about where we're concentrated.
All right.
We could change the whole complex of the legal system in America.
Well, Daruba, let me suggest to you that one of the ways we're going to do that, And I don't want to put any undue pressure on you, my brother, but we have got to have your voice and the voice of other people.
Which brings me to my
on
next
this
point.
Air regularly. Okay. You got it.
Which brings me to my next point. it's unfortunate. I mean, and I didn't want to. I'm going to try to go to this thing this evening over at in Brooklyn for Jesse. I think it's very important for us to understand that this is the moment. You're absolutely right. All voices, everybody, all hands are needed on deck right now. And I agree with you, Clayton. And you know, I've been going through agonizing periods since I've been here, since I've been back, observing this and trying to, you know, participate with our comrades and various folks trying to do progressive things. I mean, the work that the Grassroots Committee is doing, that Bob has been doing. I mean, you have individuals like Bob and Liz who have seen cases through, who have fought cases pro bono, who have been laboring in the trenches, basically unsupported. And I think that what we really have to do now is we really have to come together and talk about leadership in the city. Not leaders, but leadership. We have to build a leadership council, and we have to go to our people and mobilize our people. And I think that this is not just has to be done here. I'm going to be back and forth here on a regular basis, so you won't even miss me.
All right.
That's because the things are really getting global. I mean, you know, the elections were lost in Ghana as well. Rawlings lost the elections in Ghana, which bodes ill for us. I had just gotten a call in on Ghana from Ghana this morning that told me that one of the arch reactionaries, this Negro from Texas named Kofi Wile, who is attached to Bush and oil businesses in Texas, has came back to Ghana to run for a local office. He lost the office because both parties are basically as distrustful of him. And now he has a three-hour talk show in Ghana on a major station, and he's talking, I mean, the stuff he's talking about, like Africans are savages and they can't rule themselves, and we need the IMF, and we need corporations like Brown and Root. These are big oil corporations attached to Cheney and Bush. So this is not a coincidence what's happening here in America.
All right.
With this election.
Listen, we're going to have to close it up. Amy Goodman, I think you have a...
Yeah, Teddy Jahi's the funeral that you're trying to set up, the phone number for... information about that, Carl Franklin.
Yeah, once again, the phone number is 718-622-8292, and that's the office of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. It's 718-622-8292.
Bob
Boyle?
The funeral will be tomorrow, Thursday?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Right now, the plans are for Thursday. Carl, if that should change, please let us know as soon as possible
so we
can make that announcement. Bob Boyle, a final comment?
Okay. I just want to... thank you for addressing this issue, particularly Amy. I know you've pushed this issue for many years, as other people on the station have, and for Mimi for asking us here today.
Okay, Daruba?
And I just want to say, man, you know, I just hope that that we could try to do things for so that the remainder of our prisoners get out of jail. And BAI is a very important instrument in this fight. And programs like Sally's, yours... We really have to resolve this issue with some principle, and I think that it's very important because we're up against a regime that this is not just an election that they won. They won a major concession in terms of how they mass corporate control of politics in this country. And
I think that's very apt to say, because I think we have. Group of people now are saying we don't want to govern, we want to rule.
Well, that's what they're doing. They're ruling. I mean, the court is clear. They're ruling now. The question is whether we're going to permit them to rule us in this fashion, or whether we're going to resist. And like an old labor organizer said, are we going to mourn or are we going to organize?
You got it. Okay, Daruba, thank you very much for being with us this morning. Obviously, we're going to be talking again.
Obviously.
All right,
peace.
And Carl Franklin and Bob Boyle, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Even if Mimi Rosenberg wasn't allowed to come to the mic for her regular spot this
morning.
I want to thank her for producing the segment, right? She invited everyone to come in and to be on the telephone.
Okay, can we take...
So that was a kind of in brief.
Yes, it was a kind of in brief, and perhaps we'll take an in brief... musical break here and come back and give Amy an opportunity to continue. Let's take that number, what is it, number six, yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you got it.
Tat 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 t
Okay, it's 8:11 in the a.m. morning here. All of us, I suppose, a little bit discombobulated by recent events. Anyhow, we try to continue in a reasonable fashion. I just want to say that our calls recently for a de-escalation of what continues to be a growing warfare here at the station don't seem to be functional at all. And I do have to go back to what I said before. The reason I think we're in such decline is because of the continuing efforts to expand, to deepen and widen the divisions that exist between the station. I have mentioned before several times that I have supported the return of people. I have supported the lifting of the bans. It doesn't mean a thing. It doesn't do any good because the attacks continue. And we're not simply talking about disagreements anymore, which is really the serious problem. And I have a very serious problem attempting to continue to work with people who I think in essence are saying, you don't belong here. You're not the right kind of person to do this kind of work. And most particularly when it involves racial invective, it's all well and good to say, yeah, well, I deplore that kind of thing too. The real situation that we confront is who's going to run this radio station? Who's going to have the power to make decisions here? And I think at this point we have gone past, unfortunately for me, most particularly past that point where Brother James suggested to us that a period spent with binding mediation might be helpful. The fact is, I will go back to the statement I made, we don't have a staff anymore. We have a collection of people who are ready to lunge at one another's throats at a moment's notice or at any seeming provocation. And this is why I think it is appropriate to suggest to the Board of Pacifica that they initiate moves simply to sell the station. There's nowhere for us to go given the direction we're headed now.
Well, of course, I deeply believe in community radio, in WBAI, and I think we can move forward. People who are just tuning in now, and even people who have listened for a long time, may not know how Pacifica began, but it did begin 51 years ago by a man named Lou Hill, conscientious objector, served time in prison in World War II, who deeply believed we needed an independent media network in this country, and Pacifica is the only one. Deeply believed that there needed to be a media network that was run not by corporations, but by journalists and artists, and so Pacifica was born. KPFA went on the air in 1949, and four other Pacifica stations came into being. WBAI went on the air in 1960. It is now 2001. It's 41 years later. We must protect our station. We can go on, and I do believe we can go on whole and healthy. It's been a very, very difficult time, and it's a time when we must join together. And whatever differences people have, I think if we come back together, if the, as you said, the bannings are lifted and the people are rehired who are fired fully within WBAI's purview to do it. The general manager can do it. The executive director of Pacifica said she can rehire the people that that the executive director fired, that the general manager here can rehire Bernard, White, and Tran Harper.
Well,
we can go on.
Okay, Amy, I have to say to you, I think...
So I'm hopeful. That's
yeah,
all
well,
I want to say.
I'm glad you are hopeful, but the fact is I would have to say also that you oversimplify vastly what is involved here. And, you know, indulge in a level of wishful thinking that I think is quite unfortunate because it doesn't address the central issues that we have. And one of the problems that we have at a supposedly progressive radio station is the orthodoxy that prevails here among people who say we do not want anything to change. In other words, when you talk about people returning, what you are saying, I want to go back to what was, and nothing in that regard will ever change. And the reflection of that attitude comes from the listeners. I read letters of people say, well, what, we have to go back. We have to go back. We have to, we cannot change anything. Well, the fact is life has changed, as we all know. And what I've heard promoted by you and by others here is no, We can't change anything. We have to have, we have to set in place and keep in place an orthodoxy that says essentially that the Bernie and Amy show will be going on 50 years from now. The two of you will be sitting here having closed down the possibility that anybody else can be involved in some of these areas. What I'm saying is that change involves all of us. When it comes, we have to accept that there are legitimate reasons for it. And again, I have to say that given these deep divisions that have developed, and let me add, deep divisions that are consistently and continually encouraged, that people want there to be more and more divisions. And I think, given all of that, we should see what the possibilities are of simply saying to the board, let's move in another direction, have another radio station, and another staff of people, possibly, some of whom would be retained and others would not be. But this way simply isn't going to work. I mean, I think it's Pollyannish to suggest, oh, we'll all get back together, everything will be fine, not given some of the attacks that have been made. I am the only black person who does a morning show here on Saturday. And given the last 2 weeks of that programming, I have personally been attacked in the most vicious ad hominem way on the air by my white colleagues. Which leads me to believe that there is underneath all of this the one thing that we all consistently try to deny and suggest cannot be an aspect of what we do here, and that is racist inclinations. It does not necessarily mean people are racist, but they may in fact condone or in some cases even encourage activity by people who are. Robert, if you will.
Well, let me just say what's coming up on Democracy
yes,
Now! Today at 9 o'clock. Major actions by the new president of the United States. On the first day that he is working yesterday, which happened to be the 28th anniversary of Roe versus Wade, he moved in very quickly on the issue of abortion, reversing a Clinton policy, and moving to deny federal aid to overseas groups that provide abortion counseling or otherwise help women obtain abortions. Bush's action reversed the Clinton policy on aid for international family planning groups, which Clinton had instituted in his first days in the White House, coming on the 28th anniversary of Roe v. Wade. It's extremely significant. The White House made clear that Bush is not proposing reductions in foreign aid, but saying that they cannot go to any women's health clinic anywhere in the world where abortion is performed. And he moves on from there. We know that the Attorney General that he would like to see put in place, and that we'll see whether Ted Kennedy engages in a filibuster. John Ashcroft is fiercely opposed to abortion. Tommy Thompson, the governor of New Hampshire, governor of Wisconsin, who has been nominated for Department of Health and Human Services, fiercely opposed to abortion. This is very serious times for women. Also, Tommy Thompson saying a whole review now of RU 486, and we're going to talk about that on Democracy Now! Then we're going to look at some of the pardons and executive clemencies. We know Leonard Peltier didn't get executive clemency, get granted it by President Clinton, but Susan Rosenberg did, and we're going to take a look at her case. We're also going to take a look at Ronnie Chandler's case, whose death penalty was commuted when the guy who testified against him admitted that he did not murder the person that was alleged. And we're going to take a look at some of these cases. So that's all coming up at 9 o'clock. And just let people know the BAI is in the news again. Time Magazine, page 6 of Time Magazine, Steve Lopez's America, his column, This Just In, We're Fired, A Hostile Takeover, Rocks Radio's Voice of the Left. Take a look at it.
And take a look at that. You'll see why we will continue to be divided until the point we will not have a radio station here. That's precisely my point. We continue to bring up one side of these issues, and I'm saying that that is why we are moving to the point where some of us will actually encourage the board to sell this radio station. BAI, as we have known it, in my judgment, is over. And it is over because of the backstabbing, the backbiting, the continued refusal of people to let the temperature lower enough so that there would be some communication between some of us. This my way or the highway attitude is what, in my judgment, has sunk the ship. Thank you. Robert Knight,
well, and
with the news.
Trying to reduce some temperatures. I'm hearing some songs here this morning, Clayton. You like jazz. You like the blues.
Yes, I do.
When a person feels personally attacked, racially attacked, or ethically attacked, I'm hearing Marvin Gaye singing Inner City Broadcasting Blues. Makes me want to holler, How They Do My Life. That's you.
Well, you can take that position if you wish. Since you apparently don't wish to do the news, we can continue this conversation if you like. What I am suggesting to you is, again, whether you are right, whether Amy is right, whether anybody is right or wrong, we have moved past the point when we have
the other piece of it is Amy sings some blues for some people who are beloved, who've done a lot to construct the show, and she has a right to sing the blues.
Well, she certainly has a right to do that, but what I'm saying is we don't have a right to suggest that when you move past the point where there is any unanimity here, where there is any harmony, and we have moved past that point. All I'm saying is that my encouragement now, or my inclination, I guess I should say, is to move to the point where we simply say to the board, let's meet and let's move past this point. We have no staff here that is deserving of the name, really. We have a lot of people.
I'd like to think differently.
Well, I'm sure you do, but what I'm suggesting is the attacks are not being leveled at you. So, of course, you can take that position. The attacks are not being leveled at Amy, so, of course, you can take that position.
No, I mean about staff who love the station.
Well, I love the station, too, or I would not be here. The point of doing this doesn't have to do... I didn't go after a job here, all right? In fact... if we want to let things hang out here, I said several months ago, and Matthew Finch will confirm this, I don't want to go back there. I don't want to work with those people because they don't want to work with me. And I would prefer to be in the arts department. In fact, I'm not so sure I don't feel that way now. But the fact is we have had savage attacks. We have had secret meetings. We have had the formation of at least one cabal in here, these secret societies which have reduced staff solidarity to the point where I believe it is simply unrecoverable.
Well, I'm concerned about talk about selling the station because that's exactly the kind of provisions that have been rewritten into the new bylaws authored Mr. Murdoch.
Indeed.
The board.
Indeed. The only person being picketed by his enemies, the only black person, I might add, who is being picketed, even as there has been the savaging of Joanne Bobb, the black woman who is head of the local advisory board, the savaging of Eutrice Lead, of Bessie Wash, of Mary Frances Berry, before that. When people say, isn't there a pattern here? Everyone says, well, no, of course not. It has nothing to do with that. Why don't we get on with the news, Robert?
Well, gee, I only wish I had the wisdom of Thurgood Marshall. Here is the news. Authorities have been searching for more clues and evidence in the Colorado recreational vehicle park, where they captured four of the seven inmates who escaped from a Texas prison in a well-organized takeover of buildings and exit from the facilities. Yesterday, four of them were captured after police were informed of their presence at the trailer park. A fifth one, after several hours of negotiation, apparently shot himself to death inside the van. He is described as having expired as a result of a gunshot wound to the chest. The U.S. ambassador to Yemen is safe after her plane was hijacked. Barbara Bodine and other diplomats and no doubt intelligence officers were on a domestic flight in Yemen when a hijacker believed to be an Iraqi commandeered the plane. He was overpowered by the crew. In the Congo, there is a state funeral taking place today for Laurent Kabila, the leader who was assassinated a week ago. The government is being headed presently by his son, Joseph Kabila, the head of the army. Rebels have taken up arms against President Kabila, particularly those who are backed by troops and coordination from Uganda and Rwanda. Ethnic conflict is reported to be flaring up, and that is because of the occupation and the disparate treatment for various ethnic communities within the former Zaire, the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Meanwhile, the United Nations Security Council is urging the warring sides to cooperate in an investigation conducted by a panel looking into illegal diamond and gold mining in the country. The Congo, much like Sierra Leone, much like Angola and other diamond-rich African nations, has been the site of conflict in precisely those areas where those precious minerals and gems are mined. There was an explosion in Derry. An explosion rocked the streets around a British Army barracks early this morning, according to the RUC. The Royal Ulster Constabulary says the blast appeared to come from a van parked near the Ebrington Barracks. No one has claimed responsibility for the blast yet. Blasts continue from time to time at Vieques, where the United States Navy now is asking Puerto Rico's new governor for increased police protection after there was a conflict between protesters and naval officials. During the weekend, protesters reportedly cut fencing and threw broken cinder blocks and other objects at the Camp Garcia base, and according to the rear admiral in charge there. However, one of the leaders of the protest, Roberto Robbins, says that protesters were actually playing dominoes when the Navy started firing pepper spray at them. He denied that flammable objects were thrown at the Navy. Puerto Rico's government has agreed to provide local police to secure the base to keep out protesters and who are opposing the 5 decades of bombing on the island of 9,000 people who, by an agreement with the Clinton administration, get to vote whether or not they receive millions of dollars in aid. If they vote yes to continue the naval and NATO bombing, they get the aid. If they vote no, they don't. In other news this morning, domestically, President Bush is moving to Congress with his first bill today, an education proposal that will have in it teacher training and increased student testing. But the most controversial center of it is the advocacy of school vouchers, which have been used by private corporations and religious organizations in what critics say is an effort to remove responsibility for local governments to provide an adequate education for students. President Bush's choice for Interior Secretary Gail Norton has reportedly called voters before the election, accusing Democrats of engaging in a smear campaign. The Times says today that she did not identify herself as being a Republican, but only by the titular position of being a former Attorney General. In regional news this morning, Westchester County Executive Andrew Spano says that the federal government tells him that it's going to be all right at Indian Point. Spano made a loud proclamation asking for a clarification recently of a comment made by NRC Regional Administrator Hubert Miller, who is quoted as saying that the NRC was just an auditor of the plant and not able to monitor safety. Spano says now he's spoken to Miller and has been told that the NRC is inspecting the plant and will not let it operate if it is not safe. It did operate unsafely several months ago when an release of radioactive steam into the environment near one of the reservoirs that serves New York City resulted in its getting a red tag, one of the most severe citations from the NRC in the history of the nuclear power plant. Out in Nassau County, the police department is investigating a 5-month-old claim by a woman that a police officer forced her to perform oral sex in exchange for her release from custody. That happened last August. The district attorney's office and internal affairs are trying to determine why they weren't notified of the misconduct sooner. And in communications news, the Supreme Court has agreed to take up an internet access case. At issue is the rate that utility companies charge cable systems to attach their equipment to the utility poles. The government and the pro-industry National Cable Television Association say that cable companies get a break if they use their equipment to provide internet access, but the utility companies say the cable industry loses lower rate when it starts delivering high-speed internet service. High-speed internet service is one of the products of the biggest media corporation in the world, America Online Time Warner, whose merger was just approved by the Federal Communications Commission. And at the FCC, we now have what you might call a freedom rider. The son of the Secretary of State, Colin Powell, will now head the FCC. He has, throughout his tenure there, advanced the goals of deregulating communications markets as they become more competitive. Public interest groups say that he will not push for greater requirements on broadcasters in exchange for their free use of the airwaves. In other words, his policy as the head of the FCC, replacing William Kinnert, might be for commercial freedom and no riders on the merger terms. And finally, WBAI has made the big time, so to speak, or Time Magazine. One of the people who's been here in these studios on Wake Up Call and or Democracy Now! Is Steve Lopez, the author of the piece that's just in We're Fired, which surveys many of the issues surrounding conditions and politics at WBAI right now. It begins by saying that President Clinton lost an axle on his welcome wagon when he encountered Amy Goodman. But he concludes the article as follows after introducing the issue of Arbitron ratings and selling the station possibly and so on and so forth. He ends it this way. If Pacifica's consultant, which said that the station or network has become insignificant or irrelevant, was paid 25 cents, that he was paid too much. He says, quoting, "Everything is numbers today. The weekend box office, the president's approval ratings, the quarterly profits. For 50 years, there was one place where numbers did not exist as a measure of success or as a validation of purpose. Pacifica Broadcasting can be tedious at times, with its tie-dyed version of truth and justice. But the voice is indignant, probing, and unapologetic, and in the age of mega-media conglomeratization, an alternative view is a necessity. And I say this as someone who went on WBAI last year," writes Lopez, concluding, "knowing that I'd be a punching bag. I had written a screed about misguided support for convicted cop killer Mamiya Abu-Jamal and was attacked on WBAI air as a lazy corporate media hack. They were wrong, of course, but they were damn good at it." That's some of the news. I'm Robert Knight for Wake Up Call.
Well, let the requiems begin. It, I guess Time Magazine will herald the first note. Thank you, Robert. All right, we have a conversation upcoming with Hussein Ibish, who is Communications Director for the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee, the nation's largest Arab-American membership organization. Hussein Ibish, good morning.
Good morning. Hello.
Yeah, I'm sorry we're a little delayed. Things got pushed back, but yep. We are pleased to have you with us.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Now, you know that there is a piece, given our conversation just of yesterday, there's a piece in the New York Times today. As new peace talks go on, Palestinians criticize Clinton.
Yep.
And, of course, you and your organization, I think, have been critical of the group of people put together on the Clinton side to attempt, presumably, to bring peace between Palestinians and Israelis. Let's talk, first of all, about that team and what your principal objections to the team might have been.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think obviously our principal concern has been the policy. And I think, frankly, at this stage, we know what the results of the Clinton administration's policy towards the Middle East in general, towards Israeli-Palestinian negotiations, have been. We have a situation of all-out conflict in the occupied territories. I think it's clear that any hope that peace has been achieved, you know, would have to be dispelled by daily events on the ground, where we've had over 375 Palestinians killed in the past couple of months, many of them children, and about 50 Israelis as well, and many of them actually Palestinian citizens of Israel killed by Israeli forces, by the way, but also a number of Jewish Israelis, soldiers and civilians. In Iraq as well, where we've seen, the decimation of an entire country without any apparent policy results. So the main problem is not the individuals, but the policy. But I think the individuals themselves are worth looking at. given that they've had 8 years to shape these disastrous, calamitous policies that have achieved either nothing or the opposite of what they were intended to achieve, have been so, I think, devastating for the region and for American policy.
One of the points that that you've made in looking at this situation is that you have said that the people who were involved on the Clinton team were pro-Israel lobbyists.
Yeah, that is absolutely correct. Oh, first of all, at the cabinet level, you've got President Clinton and Vice President Gore. We had, I should say, President Clinton and Vice President Gore, both of whom are really sort of ardent supporters of Israel, lifetime passionate supporters of Israel. That's a little more true, I think, of Vice President Gore. But President Clinton has been, at a personal level, certainly the most enthusiastically pro-Israel president we've ever had. He's surrounded himself in the foreign policy and defense elements of the cabinet and senior advisors by people like Madeleine Albright, William Cohen, and Sandy Berger, all of whom are also passionate and lifelong supporters of Israel, who sort of bring an intensity of closeness to the thinking of the pro-Israel lobby that's unheard of. But then, at the next level, at the actual policy-making level, second tier of government, so to speak, there's where you see a cadre of professional pro-Israel lobbyists who are brought in to lead American policy and to shape it. I'm talking here about people like Martin Indyk, Dennis Ross, and Aaron Millard. Martin Indyk was the Assistant National Security Advisor for Near East Affairs, and he was promoted to be Assistant Secretary of State for Near East Affairs, meaning the person in charge of all Middle East policy. And then Ambassador to Israel, which he is now. Actually, he was Ambassador to Israel before, and then he was made Assistant Secretary of State. And when Barak came to power, he gently suggested that Mr. Indyk should return to Israel to help him, and in fact, immediately Mr. Indyk was sent. Mr. Ross and Mr. Miller are the chief negotiator and deputy chief negotiator for the United States for the peace talks. Now, all three of these individuals come from the pro-Israel lobby. In fact, Dennis Ross is returning, it's already been announced, to the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, which is the think tank of AIPAC, the America-Israel Public Affairs Committee, which is the principal pro-Israel lobby. So he's returning directly to the lobby. I'd like to...
If I could interject here.
Yeah, please.
Now, at least one of our listeners obviously is going to call up and say, okay,
right.
Hussein Ibish, tell us what the other side of pro-Israel lobby would be. And is there something between a pro-Israel lobby, the other side, and perhaps something in the middle?
Yeah.
Because I think the concern that people have is what policy ought there be.
Right.
What policy should be directed at this by the United States?
Right. Well, here's the thing. I mean, if you have policy being made by people who have spent most of their lives in the service of another government, of another state, working in the interests of one of the parties in a dispute, and you put them in charge of American policy towards a region where there is a dispute, and specifically towards the resolution of that dispute, what you can expect is that they'll take the side wholly of the state to whom they are passionately and professionally attached. And in fact, that's what happened. In other words, the United States, which presented itself as a mediator, as an honest broker, as a negotiator, and as the party capable of bringing the Israelis and the Palestinians together, in fact, under Clinton, took Israel's side at each and every turn. And in fact, the United States and the Clinton administration, with these various individuals that I've mentioned in charge, had run at every change of events, every change of Israeli government, every development, almost without exception. And there are a couple of exceptions, but they're hardly worth noting. To adapt American policy to whatever new situation, new whim, new policy was emerging in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem. Now, the other side of this certainly would be to appoint People who are complete supporters of Palestinian human and national rights, Arab Americans such as myself, for example. I mean, that would be the other end of the coin, and I dare say, if you appointed me, you would end up with a very pro-Palestinian American policy. The middle ground is to appoint people who aren't actually passionately committed to either side, and who could have some distance. And in fact, what we've seen, by the way, as I've said, is the results of this policy, which has been that, in fact, we don't have a situation of peace at all. What we have is a situation which is completely created by U.S. policy, in my view, and by the one-sidedness of it, which is that the Palestinians, in utter frustration, have ended up taking to the streets with stones in their hand to confront one of the world's strongest armies, and in return, getting shot down by occupation troops, as people who rebel against occupation always are. And that is the situation we have.
Let me ask this, then. If we look at the possibility of finding some middle ground here,
right.
Let's talk about some of the people, in your judgment, who would be essential to such a process.
Well, I mean, I think that, frankly, what's required is just to have disinterested people. I mean, it's not necessary. Well, first of all, I think we need to step back and say, look, I can't talk in a vacuum, right? We have a new government, a Bush administration, which has its own extremely problematic people in the cabinet. What we have essentially now is the return of the Gulf War team in foreign and defense policy. We're looking at the return of Mr. Cheney and General Powell, Ms. Rice, and all these people who were instrumental in the Gulf War and the attack on Iraq, joined by others, including Mr. Rumsfeld, who certainly provide cause for concern. On the other hand, when it comes to Israel and the Palestinians, they might be simply less enthusiastic about the whole thing, and that could actually be helpful. I'm not going to sit here and name to you individuals who I think would be useful. What I'm saying is that I don't think that U.S. policy should be dictated by lobbyists for any of the parties. I don't think that people who spend their life in the service of an Arab lobby, if there really were an Arab lobby in Washington, which there isn't, but let's say people who are sort of made a career out of advocating on behalf of Arab causes, I don't think that that will be particularly better for the United States. But I do think that what we're looking at here is the coming to power of a group of people who aren't going to be as enthusiastically committed to adapting U.S. policy to meet the interests of Israel. And in a sense, at every turn, and in a sense, many people have opined that this is going to make the prospects for peace between Israel and the Palestinians worse. In other words, that the prospects for peace depend on an American government micromanaging the process and being extremely enthusiastic about it. And I'd like to argue for a second that, in fact, it might make things better to have the United States more distant, more disengaged, less micromanaging. And, if there's some distance, two things might happen. First, you might have the United States able to play more of a mediating role rather than being a party to the dispute or a joint party with Israel. If you look at the proposals that the Clinton administration put at Camp David, and since then, they're indistinguishable from the proposals of Ehud Barak. They're precisely the same. So you have two sides in this dispute now, the Israeli-American side and the Palestinian side. That's not healthy. The second thing that might happen with distance from the United States is it might create space for more involvement from the UN and the international community, and that's badly needed, first because it will provide, I think, a much greater space diplomatically and in terms of time constraints and other things for a deal to come about, and secondly, it'll let the United States off the hook a little bit from being irresponsible for every deterioration, which is exactly what's happened now.
We're speaking to Hussein Ibish of the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. There's something ironic about the more hopeful signs coming from the Bush administration, from the Republicans,
yes,
for the future. However, the enduring question, I think, here, is there to be peace in the region in,
yep,
our time?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have to say yes, because the alternative is really too ghastly to contemplate. We've been getting a sense of it, but I think that the situation could obviously deteriorate significantly. And while Ehud Barak has been absolutely awful as a prime minister and has overseen horrendous human rights abuse in the occupied territories and has refused to take the steps necessary to end the occupation, which is what is required for peace, we are looking at the coming to power in early February in Israeli elections of Ariel Sharon, one of the most notorious war criminals in the world, a man who openly worried about NATO's intervention in Kosovo on the grounds that Israel might find itself in the same position, i.e. ethnically cleansing Palestinians again, this time from the West Bank, well, particularly from the West Bank in East Jerusalem. I think that there are levels of brutality available to General Sharon that may not be available to other Israeli politicians. In other words, Prime Minister Barak said, that if we thought that killing 2,000 Palestinians in a day would solve the problem of the uprising, we would do it, but we know that it would be counterproductive, so we don't.
Mm.
So instead they restricted themselves to killing 4 or 5 people a day. I think Ariel Sharon is probably the only politician in Israel who might say, well, let's give it a shot. You know, nothing else is worse. So let's try killing 2,000 people in one day and see what happens. Would there be peace in the region ultimately? Yes, but what has to happen is that the occupation has to end and the emergence of a viable, fully sovereign Palestinian state alongside Israel has to emerge in the occupied territories. As long as the Israelis and the Americans are telling the Palestinians that they can have a bifurcated set of Bantustans completely surrounded by Israel without any borders with any other countries, without control of its natural resources, and without sovereignty of any full and complete sense, then I don't think you're going to see that, because I don't think any people is going to agree to live under subjugation without human and civil rights indefinitely. And that's certainly what the Palestinian people have been saying over the past 3 months.
Hussein Ibish, let me ask you to give a means of communication between perhaps some of our listeners and your organization. You're located in Washington, I believe.
Yeah, that's correct. Well, we're a national grassroots organization, but our national headquarters is in Washington. I think the easiest way is through our website. That's ADC.org, as in Anti-Discrimination Committee, ADC.org. Or you could call 202-244-2990. But I think the easiest way is to go to ADC.org.
Okay. We have had, I think, a good initial conversation, but obviously there is much, much more to talk about, and I would like to be able to call on you from time to time to update the information that you've made available to us today.
Well, I'd be really happy to join you, and I think that there'll probably be plenty of opportunities that the situation regarding Iraq is likely to deteriorate, I believe. So in that sense, we'll probably have opportunities to speak as the Bush team gets going with it, whatever it plans.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Hussein Ibish from the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. We do have a call in now from Joanne Bob, who is the chair of the WBAI Local Advisory Board. She's gone. What happened to her?
She had to go to a meeting.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. She had to go to a meeting, and so she couldn't join us. Let's get rid of that. Okay. All right. Again, now let me make a point. Hussein Ibish, as we suggested to you, represents the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee. Obviously, there are many other points of view. Perhaps I shouldn't say many, but there are other points of view on this issue. We welcome them in time, I would hope, if we can maintain a degree of actual communication. It may be possible to have Hussein Ibish with us in a conversation with others who may take a different position on what is happening in that region of the world, conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. We certainly will attempt to do that. We have about 4 minutes left. Maybe we'll get out of here. We'll, why don't we bed that tune that I gave you? Which one did I give you? Number what? 11? Okay, we'll bed that. We'll take a call or two as we roll on out of here. Anthony Sloan is on on the scene with the Democracy Now! Crew. They'll be coming in at just 9 o'clock, and you know that one of the things they're going to be talking about is this Bush Act to halt overseas spending tied to abortion. Very, very important issue. Really an early warning shot in what will be a battle that I think the Bush devotees on the side of ending abortion may regret in time. They may find that there are more people within their own ranks opposed to this initiative than they previously believed. BAI, you're on the air. Good morning. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning, Clayton. My name is Garland Brown, and I want to say that I have no intentions of being threatening, insulting, abusive, or offensive.
All right.
Because that when you make a suggestion that you will go to the board and suggest that the board, that the station should be sold, then does that occur to you that maybe you and Utrice have done your job well as puppets of the board?
No, it doesn't suggest that to me at all. Thank you for calling. Thank you. BAI, you're on the air. Good morning. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Good morning. Although I have, like, some minor reservations with you, right? The flack that you do get from the coworkers on BAI, I don't think is deserving, to be honest with you.
Okay.
But I'll just end in saying this. If the House is divided, it will not stand. It's as simple as that.
Absolutely.
And listening to you, I do hear opportunity for an olive branch to be handed out. But it seems that it's always met with sarcasm and, you know, no one can end their show without throwing some dagger. And I really don't see how it's going to end.
Well, I think it has ended in some respects already. That's possibly why you're not seeing how it can end. A lot of what people have known as this station over the 40 years recently passed is over. That's the simple fact of it. An attempt was made. The olive branch you talk about has been extended many times. There are people here who will not, in my judgment, listen to a call for simply lowering the temperature and having a conversation. The attacks continue, as I mentioned before, as the only black talk show host on Saturday morning here to be inundated with assaults by my white colleagues. If I may finish, has unsettled me to the point where I just don't see supporting them or supporting the notion that the station should continue as it is currently constructed.
Because I'll be honest with you, the way things come across, it's almost as if everyone is saying it's Utrice that fired everyone, but the reality is not.
Yeah, listen.
At the same time, too, yes, Utrice has the ability to rehire, but she has to, as general manager, she has to lay down her specifics and then allow and see if the people that were fired will fit into the picture.
I agree with you, and I have to say, I'm sorry, we can continue this conversation tomorrow if you wish, but we really got to go now. We're out of time. Democracy Now! Is upcoming. Thank you. Okay, just one final note. Shut down the Street Crimes Unit. Special guest speakers, Dead Prez, on tonight, actually, January 23rd. Community meeting at Medgar Evers Auditorium, 1650 Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn. The New York City Police Watch, Malcolm X Grassroots, Center for Constitutional Rights, Medgar Evers College Women's Center. You can call 212-614-6554. Clayton Eiley saying good morning to you. We'll be back tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock. Join us then. In the meantime, give it some thought.
All right. There's one more announcement. There'll be a report to a listener tomorrow morning.
Oh, yes. I am very sorry. Lead reports that there will be tomorrow morning a report to the listener during the morning show. That is during the period, I think, probably between 7 and 8 o'clock. So please be here. Report to the listener tomorrow morning, Wednesday, January 24th. Okay? Did I do that right, Mark? Report to the listener tomorrow morning. All right.
From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
He thinks that this will help make abortion more rare, and he thinks that it is not the wisest use of taxpayer money in any case.
President Bush issues an executive order banning federal aid to